Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
REI Co-op has everything for camping, glamping, scampering, and whatever they're doing.
Cannonball!
Relaxing, axing, waxing.
I'm sorry, what?
REI waxes your skis, man.
Oh, yeah, I got it. Okay.
Biking, hiking, and whatever outdoor thing rhymes with hiking. You get it. REI Co-op is the place for gear, clothing, classes, and advice. For the million and one ways to opt outside.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to the nuclear agreement with Iran, nothing is written in stone yet. Not the exact terms of the deal, not how the parties will honor it, and not whether the U.S. Congress will allow the deal to go through. But today, we turn the lens around to try to see what Iranians see in the deal so far, in their nuclear ambitions, in the United States, in a future maybe post-sanctions, post-America the Great Satan, with Iran as a rising power in the Middle East. This hour on Point, Iran's view of the nuclear deal. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you see Iran's interests here? What's your question on how they see the deal? Do you think Iran's government is playing it straight? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Of course, Congress is all over the Iran deal today. What happens if Congress changes the deal? Big question. If the whole Congress should vote, even with a veto-proof vote, to get in on those sanctions and how they're applied, a sign-off, it could change a lot. John Kerry saying, don't do it. Don't interfere. Here he is Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press. Secretary of State John Kerry.
What we're looking for is not to have Congress interfere with our ability inappropriately by stepping on the prerogatives of the executive department of the president and putting in place conditions and terms that are going to get in the way of implementation of a plan.
But there are two parties to this plan. When Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif came home back to Tehran after those epic talks in Switzerland, he was greeted at Tehran's international airport by some cheering crowds here. Sounds pretty robust, but last week Iran's president Hassan Rouhani said the sanctions would have to be lifted on the day, the first day of implementation of the agreement. This is not what Americans have said. Here's Rouhani.
We will not sign any agreement unless all economic sanctions are lifted at once, on the very first day of the implementation of the agreement.
First day of implementation. The U.S. has said no, we'll lift sanctions as the steps are taken that are agreed upon. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, went further. He said sanctions need to be lifted on the day that a final agreement, supposed to be in June, is signed.
If you ask me if I support or oppose the nuclear agreement, I neither support it nor oppose it, because nothing has happened yet. Nothing has been done yet. The whole issue lies in the details that they are meant to discuss one by one.
Well, something has happened. Iranians are talking about it. A lot of Americans are talking about it. Congress all over it today. Let's go to Tehran. Joining me is Thomas Erdbrink, our first guest from Tehran today. He's Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been reporting on Iran since 1999 and based in Tehran since 2002. He has a seven-part video series on the Times website called Our Man in Tehran. Part four airs today. You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Thomas Erdbrink, in Tehran, in Iran, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
I don't know if we can talk about an Iranian sentiment about this deal at this point, but give us a sense of the spectrum of reaction that you are witnessing to the deal as it stands and what's anticipated at this point, as far as you can see, from different factions in Iran.
Well, of course,
to look at the politics of Iran by, you know, listening to the quotes of the president and the welcoming of Foreign Minister Zarif, we learn a lot because we can see that at least Iran's executive branch is very interested in having this nuclear deal. They want to move forward. They want to have those sanctions lifted. And they basically want to get, you know, remove the obstacles towards a better future for Iran. But the people who also matter are the people that I would meet in the elevator of my building or in the shared taxi as I go to Tehran's, you know, downtown squares. The people who ride the buses, and those people, they sort of tell me the same thing. They say, we want these sanctions lifted. We want this temporary nuclear framework agreement as it stands now to become a formal agreement on the 30th of June when of course this whole long period of nuclear negotiations must officially come to an end. For those people, the ordinary people, it can't happen soon enough. But of course, many say this should happen, you know, with keeping in mind Iran's honor and pride. And others say this should just happen as soon as possible because I want the economy to get back online and I want my children to get a job.
Thomas Erdbrink, you're there in Tehran in the United States. Backers of the deal present a stark choice. They say, be careful. It may boil down to the deal or war with Iran over its nuclear program. What about in Iran? Do you hear that formulation?
No, that alternative, I mean, there's very few people who see that as an alternative, not even Iran's hardliners who in the last months have really very nicely fallen into line with Iran's establishment and who brought, on broad terms, agree with many parts of the deal as it's shaping up, even though they have their criticisms and they have their points that they would like to see improved, you know, less compromise for the Iranians. But no, you will find very few ordinary Iranians that would think that if this deal falls through, that it will lead to war. What they fear is that it will mean a long period more indecision, of more uncertainty, of more pressures on the Iranian economy and therefore on the Iranian people. So that is why a large number of, let's say, the opinion polls say, which cannot always be trusted, but that at least over 90% of the people is in favor of a solution, a nuclear solution, and a lifting of the sanctions.
Thomas, can you give us a sense at this point, after all these years, of how acutely the economic sanctions on Iran still affect the country, still affect people's lives?
It's probably in a very different way than many Americans would expect. There are no empty shelves in the supermarkets. As you can see in the first episode of my series where I visit a supermarket, they have foreign products. One supermarket owner tells me that smuggling has increased so much because of the sanctions that there are actually more foreign products, for instance, than there were before. You also won't see it on the streets where there are modern cars, luxury cars, but you will see it in the nasty statistics. The purchasing power of Iran's long growing middle class has more than halved. People have trouble keeping up the lifestyle that they feel they deserve and that they have deserved in the past from living in an oil-rich nation. So there are pressures on families, there are pressures on the young generation. Over 70% of the Iranians is under 35 years old. These people need jobs. These people need a future. These people are students at universities. Over 60% of the all university students are female. This is a society that has modern aspirations and wants to connect with the world. And of course, that is prevented because of the sanctions. Because how can you study abroad, for instance, if you're a PhD student, but your parents can't send you money because there are sanctions on the financial transactions between Iran and other nations. So a lot of small problems, but still important problems that lead to, they can have very big effects on personal and private life.
Iran has the world's fourth largest proven oil reserves, second largest natural gas reserves. Those are very big, but they don't live like that, at least under these sanctions. What about their highest hopes here, Thomas? I mean, you quote someone back on April 2nd, right after we got this deal, saying, you know, it's unbelievable, soon we'll have direct flights between Tehran and New York. Is there a widespread sense of a possibility of normalized relations with the world, with the United States?
If you take a step back and look at the big picture, there definitely is. For 35 years since the revolution, the United States was the great Satan here, denounced at Friday prayers, denounced by Iran's ideology, and denounced by all of Iran's political leaders. But a choice has been made by the establishment to at least open negotiations with a country known here first as the Great Satan. Now we can see Foreign Minister Zarif sitting directly across from the table from Iran's representative, the United States representative, John Kerry. It is very hard, people say and hope, to go back to that time of complete isolation. People would like to see a connection with the world. And when you hear a sentence like, I hope there will be direct flights between Tehran and New York, that is, of course, a metaphor for people saying, I hope that we will become a bit more of a normal, worldly, globally accepted country.
You mentioned Iranian honor. And we've seen widespread reports that Iranians do not want to give up their civilian nuclear program, which, of course, the government says this has always been. And yet the push for nuclear weaponry within it is apparent to many observers abroad, at least. Do Iranians want the bomb? Do the man and woman on the street want nuclear weapons? And what about the government? Are there factions that want it and factions that don't? Is it an obvious goal?
It is definitely not an obvious goal. Both the government and the factions within the government, none of them has ever openly said, we want to have a nuclear weapon. Of course, if you look at the region from a strategic point of view, having a nuclear weapon for Iran would not be such a bad thing. India has nuclear weapons, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and of course Israel, even though they don't publicly say it, according to many estimates, has over 150 nuclear warheads. But at the same time, people, politicians, have fallen in line with a fatwa, sort of a religious edict by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He says nuclear weapons are useless. We have a nation of 70 million people, and we have been able to withstand a lot of foreign pressures, not just this latest round of sanctions.
Then why all the underground facilities? Why all this effort if they're useless and no need and wouldn't go there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I absolutely agree that there are many questions over Iran's nuclear program. But what I can see from that, and based on reports from the International Atomic Energy Organization, that a lot of these questions, even though they were very validly raised in the past, they have been answered by now. And that's also what came out out of the latest meeting between the UN nuclear watchdog and Iran, is that on those fronts, many questions are answered. But, of course, I am a journalist sitting here in an office in West Tehran. I cannot oversee the entire country.
Thomas Erbrink, stand by if you would right there, if you'd be good enough. Thomas Erbrink with the New York Times. We're talking about Iran's view of the nuclear deal as Congress gets all over it today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Iran's view of the nuclear deal, the view from Tehran as Washington fights over the terms. Thomas Erdbrink has joined us. He's Tehran bureau chief of the New York Times. We've got a 7-part video series out. You can link to it at our website, talking with all kinds of Iranians about all kinds of issues. This very much included. On Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation, we had Secretary of State John Kerry saying those in Congress opposing a nuclear deal should hold their fire until they see a final agreement later in the year.
I think what we have thus far are the makings of a very good agreement. And the key is now, can we shut off Iran's four pathways to a bomb? I think we've laid out an outline that does that.
Do we agree on terms? Well, not clear. John McCain, Arizona Republican senator, of course, says no, said that Iran's Ayatollah is telling the truth about what was agreed in Luzon. Secretary of State is trying to sell a bill of goods, said McCain on the Hugh Hewitt show.
The Ayatollah is probably right. John Kerry is delusional. And he came back, in my view, I think you're going to find out, that they had never agreed to the things that John Kerry claimed that they had.
And Iranians, some taking the long view. Here's a moment from my guest Tom Erdbrink's series on life in Iran. Two young Iranian women ask a fortune teller about what will come of the nuclear talks. The answer is a little Delphic. Where are our friends? And the young women laugh and respond. They're saying, everything will work out in the end. We used to be friends, that is, with the United States. Why are we enemies now? Thomas Erdbrink with the New York Times is with us from Tehran in Iran. With us as well now from Tehran, Sayyid Mohammed Marandi, lecturer in North American Studies at Iran's Institute for North American and European Studies at the University of Tehran. Mohammed Marandi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're watching the scene in Iran. You're no doubt monitoring the debate in the United States as well. Does it look to you, sir, as though we are on track to reach an agreement that both sides have a mutual understanding of and sign off on?
Well, it's very unclear at the moment because initially in Iran there was a lot of positive feelings about the agreement. But then when the U.S. President, Mr. Obama, came on television and spoke, people began to become a bit more uneasy. And then when the U.S. fact sheet came out and our foreign minister, Dr. Zarif, stated that significant parts of the U.S. fact sheet don't coincide with reality as he saw it, people were beginning to wonder if the gap has yet to be bridged. I think, though, that Iranians believe that, in general, that the Iranian government has been as flexible as possible to bridge the gap on its behalf. But I think also the Iranians believe that so far the United States government has not reciprocated enough so that a deal can be done. So we're waiting to see what will happen in the weeks ahead.
Mohammed Marandi, you're known as a conservative scholar there. Your father's a conservative parliamentarian. How much factionalism do you see within Iran? Are there others who would be much more optimistic sounding if we had them with us right now, who would be less skeptical sounding about the potential for a deal?
Well, I don't think that any of my colleagues would consider me to be conservative or reformist. I'm not in any political group or in any political party, and I've never made statements in such frameworks. I think, though, that in general, people are waiting to see what happens. And as I said, initially there was significant optimism. But when it came out that the U.S. fact sheet was very different from what Foreign Minister Zarif has been explaining in a series of interviews that he's carried out on television, I think that people feel that there is a significant gap between the two countries. So I think the real problem here, again, from an Iranian perspective, is that some of the demands that the United States are making basically run against Iran's sovereignty. In other words, the Iranian government and President Rouhani has said specifically that Iran will not accept nuclear apartheid. And so that essentially means that ultimately, while Iran is willing to be flexible to slow down key elements of the nuclear program in order to build confidence, to build trust, or to even halt parts of the program, again, to create a favorable atmosphere to solve the problem. But when he says Iran will not accept nuclear apartheid, he's basically meaning that after a reasonable period of time, the whole nuclear program, the peaceful nuclear program, should be business as usual. And the understanding from the U.S. fact sheet is that that is not recognized in the fact sheet. And that is what is a concern here. Most, the overwhelming majority of Iranians, according to polls carried out by Americans, believe that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful, and they also believe that it's a sovereign right that Iran shouldn't sacrifice. So that I think the key here is for the two issues to be brought together. On the one hand, Iran's sovereignty must be respected by the United States, and also there has to be a way forward or a solution to be found so that both sides can feel satisfied with the results.
Professor Marandi, does Iran need a deal? The pressure of the sanctions has been great and long. Does Iran need a deal?
That's not a yes and no answer. Iran would very much like to have a deal, but under conditions where Iran's dignity and sovereignty are respected. And if Iran's sovereignty, if Iran's dignity is not respected, then Iran won't have a deal. That's basically it. So right now, the Iranians feel that the United States needs Iran just as much as Iran needs the United States. The
Why?
United States over the past few decades, the United States has aligned itself with some of the most extremist regimes in the world.
Who?
Such as Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis are exporters of Wahhabism. And Wahhabism is the ideology of Al-Qaeda, or Al-Qaeda, as you say in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones who carried out, the people with this ideology carried out the attacks on 9/11. And Osama bin Laden, he was the leader, and he was a Wahhabi. And the Saudis, in recent years, they have been backing groups in Syria that are like ISIL. The U.S. Vice President just a few months ago, in a speech at Harvard University, said that U.S. allies created ISIL. And it's not just ISIL, it's other al-Qaeda groups, for example, the Nusra Front in Syria, that are being supported by U.S. allies. And some of these groups, such as the Nusra Front, are indirectly being supported by the U.S.
But what about Iran supporting the Assad regime with its barrel bombs, the huge slaughter of civilian, and other groups which have carried out terrorist acts in the region?
Well, I think I would be very happy to have a very long debate on this, because I think a lot of what is being said in the United States is very one-sided. But no, I think the Iranians from the very beginning, when the problems began in Syria, were clear that the Iranians want a peaceful solution. But what the Saudis did and what the Turks did and U.S. allies did, and the Americans allowed this to happen, is that they funded these extremist groups. In fact, your listeners, if they Google, if they use a search engine, they can search the name Belhaj, Abdul Hakim Belhaj. He was a senior al-Qaeda figure, a Libyan al-Qaeda figure. And when the Libyan regime was being overthrown, he cooperated with the Arab governments and NATO.
Mohammed Marandi, if you'd be good enough, we've got that. Please stand by. That we have callers for you from the United States,
sure.
And it's a rare chance for them to be able to speak with someone directly in Tehran. Mohammed is calling from Boston. Mohammed, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I'm actually an Iranian citizen. I've been in the U.S. for 7-8 years. And I wanted to say that I myself, my family, and my friends are all back in Iran. They're all so excited about the deal. They're so happy about it. People in Iran, including myself and I would say most of educated people, they would love to have better relationships with U.S. And the sanctions, the only thing that sanctions brought was just so much pressure on people. They couldn't get medicine. Before sanctions, Iran had a few hundred centrifuges, but after sanctions and all these crippling sanctions, they have like 20,000 centrifuges plus a vast, big nuclear program. So I wanted to say that sanctions would just bring a lot of pressure on people. It wouldn't stop the nuclear program, as you could see from before. So that's one thing. And then quickly, the second thing that I wanted to touch is that because, you know, the Supreme Leader, he said again and again that it's against his fatwa that we don't have a nuclear, we don't want to have a nuclear weapon. If Iran in one day decides to make a nuclear weapon, I would say the regime would lose all its credibility among its people. So I don't, as you see, I think that's also an important thing that we should look at that.
Mohammed, I appreciate your call. Mohammed Marandi in Tehran, a more acute description there of the pain that sanctions brings, but also the credibility issue about Iran and the potential push for a nuclear weapon.
I think your guest, your listener, your
caller,
your caller, was absolutely correct on both accounts. One is that Iranians do want the sanctions to go, and the sanctions actually have created a lot of anger towards the United States because, as he rightly pointed out, Iranians have had great difficulty even importing medicine because the U.S. imposed a sanction on the Iranian central bank and basically is threatening other countries from doing business with Iran. So people died as a result. And this, I don't think, is good for U.S. credibility or the U.S., you know, the U.S. as a, you know, the brand, as it were, as some would like to call it. But I think, yes, without a doubt, the Iranians would like to see the sanctions lifted and for the United States and Iran to treat each other as equals. The second is, and I think that he made a very good point, and that is that the fatwa is very important because
the fatwa is saying no nuclear weapons.
Absolutely, because a person who is a fatwa can't be taken lightly. A person who's make such a statement, his credibility is linked to the statements that he make. He can't just say one thing today and something else tomorrow. So it is a very important statement, and also it is consistent with Iranian contemporary history. During the Iran-Iraq War, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, and unfortunately Western countries, including the United States, helped Saddam Hussein, and they also gave him chemical weapons and helped him use chemical weapons. This is well documented. Again, some of your viewers may be surprised, but if they use a search engine and look around, they'll find
it. We've seen that history. That's not obscure history here, but neither does it mean that Iran couldn't push for a nuclear weapon, though I get the credibility issue. Let me go to Sarah, calling from Austin, Texas. Sarah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that in my viewpoint, your guest is he's just the mouthpiece for the government of Iran. If he were to say anything else, he'd be off to prison. He would be off to jail. So he's a mouthpiece for the government.
Sarah, I appreciate your call. Mohammed Marandi, you hear the note of skepticism there from Texas. I should point out, as we speak, the government in Iran has an American journalist in jail on espionage charges with the Washington Post. That's pretty disconcerting people here. If they can put an American journalist in jail, do you feel pressure to toe a certain line or face repercussions?
No, I don't, and I respect her views, and but the fact is that I think your viewers have to listen to what I have to say and do their own research and make their own conclusions. There are Iranians right now in the United States who are in jail, and there are Iranians who have been held in solitary confinement in the United States, and people in Iran feel that they've been treated unjustly. I don't know the case about the American journalists, so I can't comment on it. But going back to what I was saying was that during the Iran-Iraq War, when Saddam Hussein, with Western help, was using chemical weapons, in Iran, the leader back then, the religious leader, said weapons of mass destruction are against Islam. So he gave a fatwa. And so the Iranian government, the military, never produced chemical weapons and never used chemical weapons. So Iran's history has shown that the fatwa or the law against nuclear weapons, in the past, this law, this belief, this fatwa has been abided by when it came to chemical weapons.
So why such a big nuclear program? You have the fourth largest proven oil reserves, the second largest natural gas reserves. Why then pin so much on this very large and substantially hidden nuclear program?
Well, Tom, the answer is quite clear. Billions of dollars of Iranian money were spent by the Shah before the revolution and given to Western and American companies to create this nuclear program. A huge infrastructure.
That's a long time ago, sir. That is a very long time ago.
But many thousands of people were trained and many facilities were created. And this is Iran's sovereign right to pursue a nuclear program that's peaceful and that has been, so much money has been invested in. I think that if they didn't pursue a peaceful program after such huge amounts of money were spent, in a country that has limited resources like any other country, then I think people would be criticizing the government. The point is, and none of it is hidden. The only facility, the facility that you're making reference to,
yes,
is called the Fordow facility.
Yes.
It's underground.
Yes.
The reason why it was created in the first place was because the United States government kept saying all options are on the table.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Iran's view of the nuclear deal. The view from Tehran. Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times, has joined us from Tehran. Syed Mohammed Marandi has joined us as well. He's at the University of Tehran and with us from Tehran today. Thomas Erdbrink, Mohammed Marandi, please stand by for a moment. Hala Esfandiari joins us right now from Washington, director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Born in Iran, fled after the revolution, used to visit often. Her mother was there. She was arrested in Tehran in 2007 on charges of propaganda and espionage, spent 105 days in Tehran's Evian prison. Hala Esfandiari, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me. I never fled Iran. I left Iran. There is a big difference because I was able to go back and forth until 2007 when I was arrested.
We stand corrected, and we live with your verb. You left Iran. You departed. And I'm glad you're going to be able to go back and forth and see your mother. You pay close attention to this. How do you see the Iranian view, when Americans think what that means? Is there a popular view and a government view? Do you see big differences of faction within the government? Congress is hip deep in this now on this side of the conversation. What do you see in the Iranian view of the deal?
Look, first of all, I believe that the Supreme Leader, when he made that statement finally after 10 days, when the parameters were agreed on, was not so against the deal. I think he was consulted at every step of the way. But when he saw the reaction in the United States, you know, when the fact sheet was circulated, which differed from what Foreign Minister Zarif had told the Iranian people and reported to him, and also, you know, the all-out effort of the administration to sell the parameter to Congress and to the American people. So he had to take a stand. But basically,
you mean on saying the sanctions would be lifted the instant it was signed?
Yeah, he didn't say the instant it was signed. He said the sanction should be lifted after it was, after the deal was signed.
Okay.
And he also said if we need to extend the negotiation for another month or so, there is no problem with that. And, you know, he also, as both your speakers said, talked about respecting Iran's wishes and Iran's dignity. So, you know, and my sense is that his reaction is because the people really would like to see an end to sanctions. And I think the president of Iran, Mr. Rouhani, who came to power precisely because he had promised that he will do his best to get a nuclear deal, to end Iran's isolation, to improve the economic situation of the people he would like to deliver. And that's why Mr. Zarif announced today that there is going to be, the negotiations will resume on the 21st of April at the level of, you know, on the secretaries from the P5 plus one and Iran. So I think the people still have not given up hope, and nor has the Iranian leadership, that there is a light at the end of this tunnel.
Thomas Erdbrink, in Tehran, of course, this deal is not in perpetuity. There are, you know, periods of years, 10 years, 15 years and more, that different elements of it would expire. And we've been led to see this as a period during which there's a hope that relations between the United States and Iran would change. Iran's interests might change in nuclear development, that this would be like a kind of long breathing space. And by the time it's over, we might have a different relationship with Iran, friendlier relationship, and therefore its actions would be less worrying. Does that view have currency in Tehran, Thomas?
Well, I would actually like to refer to the same speech as Mrs. Esfandiari was referring to by Iran's supreme leader. He said very specifically in that speech, and a lot of analysts took note of that, he said, if, of course, this nuclear deal actually leads to something, and I'm paraphrasing here, then we can explore other discussions with the Americans. But of course, he also added, if the nuclear deal fails, then we will of course not, and we will be more confirmed in our views that the United States is untrustworthy. But he, as the supreme leader of this country, very clearly said that such options are open. And of course, a main source of cooperation would be something that Mr. Marandi referred to, the rise of the Islamic State in the region, the support that these groups are getting from all kinds of countries here in the Middle East, and Iran, that is leading the fight on the ground, at least in Iraq, against the Islamic State. So that is an area in which both countries have both said that they would like to cooperate. And if there is an improvement of relation, if this huge obstacle of nuclear talks is taken, that might happen.
Mohammed Marandi, can you see the potential for a strategic reorientation here? I mean, the Americans have seen the great Satan marches and signs and old graffiti for a long, long time now. It's kind of hard for some to believe. But could there be a fundamentally different and better relationship between these two countries?
Well, I think, you know, when you speak about, you know, the slogans of the past and the great Satan and all that, you have to take into consideration that the Iranians do have grievances. I mean, the U.S. supported the Shah, they staged a coup. Even the U.S. embassy takeover was because the United States gave refuge to the Shah, and people saw him as a mass murderer.
So, everybody, you know, has grievances, and we're thinking about the future now.
Yeah, so I'm saying that, you know, the Iranians, you know, Saddam Hussein, U.S. support for Saddam Hussein, these grievances exist, and therefore that makes it difficult to bring about change. But as your guest rightly pointed out, Ayatollah Khamenei, he said that if there is a reasonable agreement with the United States on the nuclear program, and the United States, you know, Iran showing flexibility, and the United States respects Iran's sovereignty, and we have a deal at the end of the day, then this would be a sign that we can discuss other issues as well. So he said that quite specifically and very clearly, and in public. So we really have to see what happens in the weeks ahead. And there are forces at play that are very much against the deal. For example, the Israeli regime's prime minister came to Washington. People in Iran watched him being applauded by both Republicans and Democrats in a way in which the U.S. president wouldn't be applauded. And that, for Iranians, is a cause of concern. Is the U.S. political establishment deeply divided? How much authority does the U.S. president have under such circumstances? And then there's also Saudi Arabia, which, as we've been discussing, has been supporting extremist groups in Syria, in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Syria, Iraq, different groups like ISIL and other Al-Qaeda groups like the Nusra Front. And this extremism is spreading, this Wahhabi idea.
Yeah, we've talked about that. Yeah. And there are many brands of extremism. Let me ask you about something that you raised, Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. One of the things Israel has floated is the desire to, and this has had some pickup by American politicians, that they'd like to see a provision in a deal whereby Iran would acknowledge Israel's right to exist. Could you picture that being part of a deal, Mohammed Mardi?
The Iranian view on Israel, first of all, let me just clarify one thing. Never has Iran, any president, anyone in Iran, threatened Israel with a military strike. And
that's a matter of interpretation, clearly. I mean,
well, exactly. And the translation of the particular statement that you're making reference to is inaccurate and it's well documented. The Israelis have often made threats, but the Iranians have never made a threat. The Iranian position on Israel has been clear for 30-some years now that Iran sees Israel as an apartheid state. Americans could disagree with that. This is how Iran sees it. They see it like apartheid South Africa, and therefore they say it does not have moral legitimacy and that Zionism is a chosen people and so on. The Iranians believe that as long as Palestinians are treated as second-degree citizens or as long as they're subjugated, then it doesn't have legitimacy. But if Palestinians and Israelis have, and Jews and all have equal rights in that country, that would be a completely different situation. So Iran's opposition to Israel is identical to Iran's opposition towards apartheid South Africa in the 1980s.
Let me go to Randy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Randy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I was in Iran last in January of this year, 2015. And
okay.
Prior to that, I was there both in 1983, 1981, and 1980. I started my photojournalism work in Iran to cover what was happening during the hostage crisis,
mm-hmm.
and now have gone back to see the changes in the country. And I was quite overwhelmed by what I saw, and more importantly,
in what way,
I
Randy?
Well, Iran is like a modern European capital. There's metro systems, there's buses, people are active, involved in their communities. There's malls being built, extravagant malls.
What should we take from that?
What do we take from that?
Yeah.
We take from that it's a country that's developing, a country that has a lot of the same values as we do have here in the West. I think that there were endless communications that I would have with people, always, conversations that the Iranians wanted to have with me as an American. They wanted to know what we were, thinking about relations. I think after 30 years of not having relations with the United States, it's very highly educated, very modern, very intelligent community of Iranians would very much like negotiations.
How should what you found there, Randy, factor into American thinking about a nuclear deal and the effort to forestall an Iranian nuclear weapons program?
Well, I think the nuclear deal for them is, as I think Tom Erbrig had said so very, specifically and importantly, that there are nuclear development of certain things, not nuclear weapons, that they're very much interested in securing and maintaining because it's something that they take pride in for the,
So you're not worried about nuclear weapons?
I don't feel, am I worried about nuclear weapons? I didn't get any indication that Iran wants to continue in any particular direction towards a war against any people that would evolve into more loss of lives within Iran, having interviewed people before.
Yeah,
the war
Randy, I appreciate it. Our time is short here, but we got that view, and I'm glad for that updated view from the streets. And I can relate to what you're conveying there, definitely. At the same time, negotiators look at 20,000 centrifuges and have to do a kind of calculation here. We're talking about Iran's view of the nuclear deal. Let me get one more call here. Thousand Oaks, California. Darius, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Basically, my comment is that something that I don't think I'm an Iranian-American. It's something I don't think that a lot of Americans know or understand is that the motivating philosophy to kill Americans, when you see Americans getting their heads cut off on videos, and the people that are motivated to attack Americans. I know you mentioned this once, but they don't come from the philosophy that comes from Iran. They come from the philosophy of Saudi Arabia, of Wahhabism, of Salafism, of American allies. And I think it's a great tragedy and a great irony that the people that we support are actually the people trying to kill us.
Do you think we could have a fundamentally different relationship with Iran after so many decades of hostility?
I think we could, because we're natural allies. We have the same enemies. The same people are trying to kill both of us. That's just the bottom line. That's the truth. The same people that are trying to kill Americans are the same people that are trying to massacre Shiites and massacre Christians and massacre Kurds.
Darius, we've got it. Again, my time grows short. Hala Esfandiari, what about it? Could you imagine natural allies here? After all, this is a government that put you in jail for a long time.
Look, as Tom Erdebrink said, 70% of the Iranian population is under the age of 35. They are looking to the future. They couldn't care less about past history. They would like a normal country. They would like to reach out to the outside world. They are interested in what is happening in the rest of the world. So I think they would like to have a deal, and they want to just leave the past behind them, and the United States possibly will reciprocate.
Mohammed Marandi, if the U.S. Congress gets in here, and they may well, after committee hearings and votes come in and try to say they want a congressional sign-off on the sanctions, could the deal survive that U.S. congressional workover?
No, I think that if the U.S. government's hands are tied, then that would probably lead to the end of the negotiations, and the United States would be blamed for it. So I think that it would be a major mistake for anyone in Congress to pursue that line. I think that what your guest Darius said was very correct, that in fact, those countries that are allied to the United States are the ones that are exporting extremism under the nose of the United States. And I think Randy, I think that was the name of your other guest, was quite correct in saying that Iranians are normal people. And
but what about Hezbollah? I mean, you know, many people can export all kinds of things.
Look, Hezbollah is a political party in Lebanon that is recognized by the Lebanese state as legitimate. Hezbollah fought Israel when Israel was occupying Lebanon. Hezbollah never went inside Israel. Hezbollah, too, sees Israel as an apartheid state, and it feels for the Palestinian people. But Hezbollah has never launched an attack or initiated war. Their country was occupied by the Israelis in the 1980s, and they staged a war of resistance. And that,
Mohammed Marandi, we're out of time at that point, and I'm sorry for it, but I'm grateful to you for being with us today. Mohammed Marandi, lecturer in North American Studies at the Institute for North American European Studies at the University of Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Hala Esfandiari with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Our thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.